Yes, this is your host. Was that too early, Walt?
A little bit. Try again.
But man, damn it. Performance anxiety. Okay, I think about baseball. All right. Hey, folks. Thanks for tuning into the Banff Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Lafferty, here with my frequent co-host and life partner, Walt Robillard. And we've got a couple of celebrity guests with us today. Sean Patrick Shannon. How you doing, Sean?
Good to see you guys. You're seeing less of me these days.
Yeah, Sean recently had bariatric surgery, and he's an incredible shrinking man right now.
Booyah.
So congrats on your recovery, Sean. And last but certainly not least, Mr. Steve Kenson, who needs no introduction, but we're going to give him to him anyway. How you doing, Steve?
I'm very well, thanks. Good to be back.
Yeah, good to have you. So just to get down to brass tacks, we're here to talk about Strikeforce, which is a huge deal. It's taking over Kickstarter right now, and you guys are doing some writing for that. So which one of you guys would like to give the uninitiated a quick introduction to what all Strikeforce is all about?
Well, I'll start with, if you don't mind, I'll start with the story of how this came about.
Please.
Of course, the passing of Aaron Alston was a terrible tragedy for our hobby and industry, and a great shock because he fell out during a convention, and there was a lot of stuff going on where, you know, people didn't know what was going on, and where people were reaching out, and in great part because of my Sean's Pick of the Day and other stuff that I do to promote and talk about stuff, people were reaching out to me and saying, Sean, do you know anything? So being connected to the family, Stacy Olson, one of my friends online, I reached out to him, found out what's going on, and I told him, well, there's a lot of people asking, and if there's anything I can do, please let me know. So the family came back and said, hey, we'd be very grateful if you kind of help let people know. And I said, okay. So I did. Anyway, the family... Afterwards, when Jason Walters of now High Rock was Blackworm, now transitioned to High Rock Press, approached them about doing a revival book for Strikeforce because it was something that Aaron had always wanted to do and had been conversed about amongst the hero folks for a while, they actually asked him, we would feel comfortable if you would ask Sean if he would be involved, which was an incredible honor. I was very deeply moved by that. Unfortunately, I'm doing this thing called Savage Rift right now. It's very involved. There's massive lots of stuff going on with that. So I couldn't commit to that as being the lead guy on that. But I did say that I felt Evil Beagle, as a publishing and development house, could work with Jason. And that, in fact, I felt that Ross Watson, who is our managing director, would be the best project lead for that. And Ross and I both agreed, and we'd actually, interestingly enough, had a conversation prior to any of this saying, you know what, Strikeforce, if it ever gets redone, we know who the guy should be to do it. And that was, I'm breaking up,
Sean.
Ah, crud. Am I still breaking up?
Yes, sir.
Sorry,
friends. However, on the good news, I've just sent links to this Hangout to Mike Serbrook and Ross. They should be joining us in just a moment.
All right. Well, let me cowboy up here, as it were.
Well, Sean is MacGyvering his audio setup. Steve, could you let's pretend we have a listener who's uninitiated into the secrets and history of Super's RPG history. Could you maybe give them some background on what Strikeforce was back in the day and why it's important to modern gamers? Did I just kill all conversation with that, sir?
I got it. So the Strikeforce source book was basically Aaron Alston's home champions game back in the day. Aaron liked to say that he basically started a playtest of champions in order to review it for Space Gamer, and then that playtest lasted about 20 years. And he had an extremely long-running game set in this world. And Strikeforce was really unique, especially at the time, because in addition to just being a look at someone's existing campaign with all of the profiles of the various characters and a look at the setting, Aaron really drew back the curtain about how he ran the campaign and really looked at a lot of stories of how different things came up in the course of the game and how he and his players handled them in terms of everything from conflicts between the player characters over the issues of whether or not superheroes should kill in combat, to players who seemed to be losing interest in the game because the adventures weren't addressing their particular interests at the table. You know, players who wanted to see romantic subplots, and Aaron as Game Master wasn't initially aware that that's what they wanted. So there was a lot of Game Master advice, both in the form of, you know, just general do's and don'ts, but especially in the form of a lot of anecdotes taken right from the history of the campaign, where Aaron says, look, learn from my experience. Here is the benefit of what I have seen, and here are ways we've worked, you know, to solve these particular issues. And it was just groundbreaking at the time.
Yeah, these days it's considered de rigueur to incorporate discussions in a new project about how to run the game and the kinds of things you should pay attention to and how to interact with your players. And there are websites and podcasts like this that abound that all are about the craft. There was no discussion of craft when this book came out. This was the book that set that up. This was the book that opened eyes across the board from publishers to GMs to everyone about looking at what we do and how we do it, as opposed to just jumping in and hoping it all comes together okay. So whereas it was such a profoundly interesting book for Champions players to look at an existing, very integrated and very involved campaign, and that by itself made it an awesome piece of work, well written by Aaron, it was also, as Steve said, exactly that, groundbreaking. It taught us how to look at the process and look at our players and look at what's going on and structure a campaign, not just for supers, but just across the board, how to examine running a long-term campaign that involved characters and their stories and their interests and figuring out how to manage each individual player's approach to things, because they, like Steve said, they're different types of players, different interests, and if you didn't reach them, you're going to start losing them. So those of us who study the craft, that's the foundational book. Looks like we got some other people on.
Yeah, we have joining us Ross and Michael.
Hey, Ross. Hello. I'm glad you guys could make it.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys.
So Ross is the project lead on Strike Force, and, of course, Michael Sobrick, as I said earlier, is the man that he and I both said to Jason, we know the guy who has to write this. We know the guy who has to do the research and do the new material, the primary new material, because no one's been carrying the torch longer or more profoundly for the Hero Games legacy than Mike Sobrick. So it's been an honor and a pleasure to work with all of these incredible people on this project.
Michael, is it true that you must have combed through about 14 feet of documents for this project?
I can't say 14 feet. I can say over 5,000 files and possibly upwards of 100 of a million words and several thousand pages of material. Actually, no. Thousands and thousands of pages. One single PDF was over 3,000 pages. So, yeah.
The estimate that we made when we first started talking about the Strike Force campaign, after we looked at all the material and all the different sessions that were run, we came up with an estimate that it's roughly equivalent to about 400 issues of the Avengers.
Yeah, this was a really long-term campaign. I was looking at moving to Austin, Texas at one point, just to give you a sense of how well-known and important this game was and how much people wanted to connect to it because they kept hearing all these amazing things. I was looking at moving to Austin at one point. One of the first things I did was reach out to Aaron and say, hey, Aaron, I know you're running an awesome Champions campaign, and I'm looking at moving to Austin if I move there. And before I even finish, he's like, Sean, I'd love to have you, but unfortunately I have a waiting list that includes people, you know, that I've known in this industry for a long time who are deep friends, and they're waiting to get in too. He had one of the best-known waiting lists to get into his campaign. Mm-hmm. It had that kind of impact.
It's pretty impressive when your campaign has a velvet rope, you know?
Yes.
Did you guys have bouncers too?
It was just a matter of respect at that point, you know. You know, but people were waiting. They were champing at the bit. They're like, if I, you know.
One of the first players was Steve Jackson, the Steve Jackson of Steve Jackson Games. And, of course, Dennis LeBay, who's the artist behind all of the Wing Commander games and things of that nature.
Yeah.
Who's also Dennis, doing all the art for the current project, by the way. Or doing all, is he doing all of it or a lot of it? I can't remember.
The cover and the interior pieces, he's doing, we're trying to do as much as he's willing to do, but I can't say he's going to do it all.
Jumping back real quick, something I just remembered, to give you an idea of the scope of the research. So I'm talking to Ross, and I'm like, oh, I should be a week. Ross, it's going to be 2 weeks. Ross, I think it's going to be 4 weeks.
It ended up as 6 weeks worth of research.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's huge.
So much happened after that. So much happened after that first book was published. I mean, again, it went on for years and years afterwards. And of course, not only did Aaron have all that tons of additional material that fleshed out the campaign further, but he also had revised his own thinking about gaming and the craft and things to be done. So, you know, this is one of the reasons why he wanted to do a new version of the book, not just to update the campaign, but to update these ideas.
It's also important to note that, yeah, it's more than just Strike Force. A term that gets used in the material that I wrote for the book is, and which is a term Aaron himself used, is Earth AU, Earth Alston Universe, because there was not only Strike Force and the Shadow Warriors, which is what we're familiar with in the original book, but he ran, and we're talking about 50 to 75 to 125 sessions of Twilight Falls, which was in Minnesota, which was heavily soap operic, but also concurrent with his Strike Force game. He ran multiple pulp series, Empire Club and El Dorado Society, with 120 some odd episodes. He ran 50, 60 episodes of his Lands of Mystery game in Zorander. He ran, and I could keep saying he ran, and then fill in a blank, and he ran. Mm-hmm. And he also ran 125 sessions of Age of Heroes, which is the Mythic Greece setting that he did to playtest Mythic Greece, which had no connection to the Earth AU. So he ran, and when you combine it all together, you get a very well thought out, maybe not well thought out because it did hodgepodge like any comic universe, but you get an extensive... and at times well thought out, because he would revise his thinking on what he was doing, but, you know, setting that had everything you would want in it.
Yeah. Speaking of comic universes, I like that the new Strike Force material touches upon the fact that Aaron mentioned in his very first Space Gamer article on the setting, which was basically Aaron shamelessly raided from all of the existing comic and pulp universes, you know, extent at the time, and that although obviously for, you know, copyright and trademark purposes, you know, the original Strike Force book couldn't mention any of that, that basically his original superhero universe was basically a combination of all of the pulps and classic Silver Age comics all mashed up together in one big universe.
Pretty much. I mean, one of the things that I would send Ross emails as I read was, you're not going to believe this part, or you're not going to believe this, but he actually pulled from stuff as it appeared. He didn't actually go back. So wait, let me get my brain in gear here. He went back and he pulled stuff that he liked out of the Golden Age, out of the Silver Age, but he pulled from the Bronze Age. I mean, he had the X-Men as we commonly, at least I know him from the 80s. He had the Teen Titans, sort of an 80s feel. At one point, I'm reading along, and I'm like, wait a minute, did he just mention Hanoi Zan, the arch enemy of, yes, he did, of Buckaroo Banzai? So he was pulling from popular culture constantly, but he integrated it well. We actually had a long discussion, or I wanted to know, and we talked to Dennis, like, what do you do when you live in a universe that has Dr. Fate and Dr. Strange and Captain America and all that? And he used them often as plot devices. You know, the Avengers are the premier super team, so they're out fighting Threat A, but they come to the Strike Force and they say, hey, Threat A also has Threat B, and we know you guys are tough. Can you take that? And then Aaron feeds the players these plot threads under the guise of, you know, there's other teams and they all have things going on, and can you help them, or can you grab something like that? Or they go to consult. we're going to go talk to Doctor Strange. And he says, well, this is what I know. But he often hands the ball back to the players, although sometimes they accompanied the players and fought alongside them.
The amount of plot threads and characters and things that were going on in his universe that Aaron could keep straight in his mind is just shocking. The man was a machine. I promise you, he was a robot sent from the future to teach us how to roleplay, because he knew all of these things all of the time about his campaign.
And yet, he also was very good about engaging his players as part of the process. And that was one of the things I learned from the first Strike Force, was to get my players engaged in more than just, I have a character and I'm sitting at the table waiting to roll dice. Aaron spoke extensively about, you know, you want cool stuff to happen. Well, you know, be a part of that process. When we talk about narrative, you know, input from players these days, it's a, you know, there's the indie game scene, and then, you know, pretty much we look at 21st century influences on game, and there's lots of narrative involvement and the player working with the GM, both not just behind the scenes, but at the table, and players getting to exert narrative control. All these things are really great developments, and I'm not taking anything away from anybody else who has helped evolve the state of the art, but you can look back at Strike Force and see our early ideas of that concept coming together, because he would employ his players to, you know, through the blue booking thing, which just there's that article posted today about that, which I was really great to see, because blue booking was such a evolutionary idea at the time, and now we can blue book online. We didn't have that back then. Mm-hmm. But engaging the players to be involved in the narrative process was one of the magical things about Strike Force, and about what Aaron was telling us, that was, even though it took me a while to figure out how best to employ it, it never left me. And I think it's important to realize that, you know, he was really pointing the way towards that.
Mm-hmm. So I had an interview with Jeffrey Jacobs, who plays Itchy Bond. And if anybody knows your Strike Force, you know, Itchy Bond did one of the most game-changing events in Strike Force history. He's the guy who assassinated Power Lord. Mm-hmm. And I asked him about that, and I was like, did Aaron expect that? And Aaron didn't expect that. That took him by surprise. But as what Sean, going with what Sean said, instead of the old school-ish, no, that fails because it interrupts the plot. It's not where the railroad's going. Aaron said, really? That's what you're going to do? Let's sit over here and talk about how you're going to do it and what it means and how this plays into your Bushido Cyclim. And Jeffrey even admitted, though, that he told him, like, hey, your cyclim, as I understand, but the code of Bushido means this, 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 and this. And Jeffrey Itchy Bond goes, okay. And Aaron didn't mention that assassination is sort of a cowardly act. You would actually want to call him out. So he gave Itchy Bond some rope and then let the player hang himself with that rope. But he took all that, what he was going to do and the outcome, and he just said, okay, this makes a whole new plot. I'm going to work with it. And I think Dennis... Ross, am I right? Dennis said he was very good at just grabbing and flowing with the changes. Yeah. But he also did something that was very important, and I think Dennis feels is very important, that he was more than willing to say, hey, let's take 15 minutes. Let's get some food. Let's do this. I need to think it real quick. So instead of he was willing to stop, take a step back, look at what he'd been handed, and figure out what to do with it, as opposed to, you know, I just got to keep rolling, because he didn't want to screw it up. He wanted to make sure that everybody, that it worked well with what was going on, and he had a satisfactory answer or conclusion to what the players had presented him with.
Yeah, in Strike Force, Aaron was way ahead of his time. I mean, we talk about things today that are things like player agency and the importance of story and iteration and the social contract, and all of the basis for those things is really in Strike Force. He was already talking about that in 1988. He just didn't have the language we have today. Now, you want to talk about blue booking. That was, you know, obviously the most impactful technique that he presented, because I wrote about it. But what I wrote about is just a little piece, you know, of what Steve Kenson wrote about. He wrote this fantastic thing on blue booking that I cannot wait to share with people. It's how awesome it is.
Thank you.
You did a fantastic job, Steve.
Well, I mean, blue booking had a big, it was quite the revelation.
Yeah, and you write about the impact it had on your campaign.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I pointed out in my essay, blue booking very nearly self-destructed my campaign.
In a beautiful way.
in a fantastic way, because it set up this incredibly dramatic conflict between a couple of the player characters. that came as a real shock to both them and the rest of the group when all of the storylines finally converged and they became aware that two of the characters were essentially working at cross purposes against each other. And there was just this tremendously powerful, tense, role-playing session involving these characters at the table that, you know, couldn't have happened if I had had to try and play out the plot lines in a conventional fashion, either with the players aware of what was going on and having to compartmentalize their player knowledge versus their character knowledge, or if we were trying to do this kind of extensive subplot work, you know, in the traditional fashion of just passing little notes back and forth, we would have never gotten anything this detailed out of it. So it really just added an entirely different layer to the game that we could play around with. And now, you know, like Sean pointed out, we've got so many more multimedia tools for doing blue booking style gaming that, you know, the opportunities are considerable.
I want to expand on that a little bit. I devote a little bit of space in my section of blue booking, and I do mention some of the tools, including what we're using right now, Google Hangouts and such. But I want to throw a little bone to Walt there, because he told me he's a Cause 5 fan. A lot of the source book that you read, if you get the 6th edition source book, is due to the fact that I ran a play by email for like 5 or 6 years in that setting. And looking back, it was not a play by email game. It was really a case of, it was 5 or 6 or 7 years of blue booking between anywhere from 5 to 20 people with a monthly schedule, which allowed, as Steve says, to build a very rich universe with a lot of ideas and such bandied about that would not have occurred or been easy to do in face-to-face play, but let us explore these characters and interact and describe things in a pretty satisfactory and fun way. Let me turn that off. Sorry. That is work intruding.
Hey, no worries. Hey, quick question for you guys. Let's just, for any listeners who might not, have looked at the Kickstarter page yet, what exactly is a backer going to be getting if they back this Kickstarter?
Well, Ross can answer this one fully. He's been the one putting. But Ross has been on the front line of putting a lot of this together and structuring it, and then restructuring it. It's been some really fun meetings we've had about exactly what we want to do and how we want to do it. We want to get it exactly right. I think he nailed it on the head. So,
well, right now the Kickstarter is for a new version of Strikeforce. It's going to be updated. It's going to be bigger. It's going to be over 200 pages. It's going to include all kinds of new updated material that Aaron was working on when he died, plus some work from myself, from Sean Fannin, from Steve Kenson, that are riffing on Aaron's original ideas for the game mastering style and techniques that he pioneered. So this is going to be the book. Strikeforce is the book you want if you want to run a memorable, long-lasting superhero campaign, because it's going to have all that material in there to show you how Aaron did it. And he's going to talk about the things that he did wrong. He's going to talk about the top 10 ways to ruin your campaign, right? And all these lessons learned along the way of 22 years of actual play are going to be in Strikeforce, along with this fantastic setting, along with 31 characters, both heroes and villains. And there's different levels, obviously, on the Kickstarter. One level you get just the PDF. We're also offering the physical book. And one of the add-ons that I think I really want to talk about is you get access to this archive that Michael was talking about. You get access to the 800 megabytes of notes that Aaron had put together for Strikeforce. And to me, that's really exciting. We're even offering a PDF of the original 1988 version for people who want to check it out. And there's even more stuff along the way. I mean, Michael's got a special Strikeforce adventure he's writing for everything over $100. We're trying to get to a stretch goal that includes a fiction book with guys like Mike Stackpole and Mel Odom. So there's a lot of really exciting stuff going on with the Kickstarter. I hope I want to extend my gratitude to you guys for letting us come on and talk about it, because I hope people will go check it out and take a look at all the really cool stuff that's coming up.
Yeah, we want to hit that. We really hope to hit that 30,000 because we want to see the color. I think Dennis and Fulton's interiors with the colors, everything is going to be just kicking.
Yeah. Although the original, Strikeforce book, like most of the RPG books, at that time, was a black and white line art book. You know, if years of working with games like Mutants and Masterminds have taught me anything, comic book, you know, superhero games really just demand color art to really do them justice.
Absolutely. Totally agree.
So right now you guys are at about 25,000. It looks like full color happens at 30.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What level does the short story and anthology kick in?
Short stories, we get a hardback at 40,000, and then the short story anthology kicks in at 50,000, which is, we got a really amazing lineup of authors for that, if you want to take a really quick look. We got Jane Linscold, we got Elaine Cunningham, we got Dave Gross. I think we got like a quarter of the Forgotten Realms writers are on board for this thing. Nice. So it's pretty exciting stuff. These guys are all really friends of Aaron, and they know superheroes really well. Like Richard Lee Byers has got a set of stories called The Imposter, which is fantastic. You should check that out. And then beyond that, of course, you know, we have plans for the future. Aaron and the Alston Estate actually has been very generous to us with all of his material. There's enough stuff there to keep writing Strike Force and The Blood and Circle and Medi and all this great stuff from his universe for years and years. If the interest is there, we will absolutely make it happen.
I guess we should point out that this is not just Hero System. Correct me if I'm wrong, if people back this, they're getting stats for the characters, and what else systems are included? Why don't you guys tell me?
We've got Mutants and Masterminds, and thanks to Steve Kenson's generous involvement, we have Icons. And we're doing a Savage Worlds one as well. So we have three additional systems that are available. Now, keep in mind that this book, really the rule sections in it are pretty small. Like you're just mostly getting the character sheets of the heroes and villains, so it doesn't really matter what system you play. Any superhero game you play, this book is going to be really useful for you. Mm-hmm. But we are covering four of, I think, the biggest superhero systems all at the same time, so there's that as well. Yeah, absolutely. And those are all either included with a certain level, or it's like a $5 add-on to just get them all.
I think it's a $20 level.
Is it? Yeah.
PDF and gets to that. And I will actually argue, we were on another podcast, and I argued this, that I don't care what you're running. You could be running Star Wars. You could be running D&D 5th Edition. If you're planning on running any campaign of any length, or even if you're going to run it in arcs and have interruptions, you might want to look at this book. There are suggestions and hints and ideas and techniques that Aaron used that apply to any game that you run. He runs in seasons, actually.
Let's talk about those seasons really quick. The thing that I love about this is Aaron will say, at the beginning of a new season of gaming, what he'll do is he'll pass out a little sheet to every player saying, what is it you want to do this year? What's your character up to? Right? And he would take that information back to the Batcave, right, and work on it so that he would have all these subplots and stuff ready for you. Like, if he was doing... Like, let's say Steve Kenson is playing Iron Man, okay? And he says, what do you want to do this year? And Steve says, well, I want to enhance Stark Industries, I want to romance Pepper Potts, and I want to track down information on Ironmonger, right? And Aaron's like, okay. And all three of those things will then show up sometime in the next, 10 sessions, which I think that's a wonderful idea. And you could apply that technique to any game.
Yeah.
And what he, and in case you're wondering what is meant by seasons, he ran, because he had so many games going, in order to give everybody enough face time and keep everybody's interest in the various games, he might run for 4 to 6 months. So you might have 4 to 6 months of Strike Force. All right, we're going to run 4 to 6 months of Age of Heroes. And after that, we're going to run 4 to 6 months of Twilight Falls. And we're going to cycle through these two or three primary games on this particular day. And a lot of the other games we're playing, we're going to do on another 2 days. I think he ran 2 to 3 times. They played like 2 to 3 times a week. And that way, you know, he would run through a set of plots. And once everybody had their fill, it'd be like, okay, you know, in order so that we don't burn out, we're going to switch to another set of characters, another setting. We'll do the same thing with that. So everybody kept their interest fresh. And we're interested in looking for more, and that way he didn't burn out, and the players didn't burn out. I see it right now with Netflix. I'm just sitting there, like, going, for the next season of Daredevil and Jessica Jones and Arrow to show up on Netflix, and it actually works. I can binge when it's there, and then they keep me waiting for them when it comes around again, and then I binge again. And it's the same with how he ran.
I definitely had a sense that I wanted to be Aaron Alston when I grew up, not just in terms of being a successful author, but being a successful game master. And I'm still struggling to accomplish things that I've known from his original work for years, and I'm sitting here, listening to you guys talk about it, I'm like, yeah, I really should be doing that. Why am I not doing that? You know, right now, like the games I've got going on, like right now I'm running a really cool campaign with an all-star cast of players I'm excited about, and, you know, I told them, I said, I want to run a game that feels like the best of what Aaron did with Strikeforce. I want that long-term game with all these great players and this involvement. And it's frustrating to a point just because everyone is so busy, they can't invest the kind of time that it feels like we all were able to do way back when. But it's still something I want to strive for, right? I want us to try to have that sense of long-term goals. And again, it just cannot be said enough. It's like, that's like, well, of course, everybody wants that. Well, we didn't know we wanted that until we started seeing how cool it could be back then.
I guess that kind of leads into my next question is, do people run games like this anymore? I mean, you mentioned everyone's so busy and everyone's so distracted by online gaming, you know, Netflix, you know, all the other pressures of modern life. Are people doing this kind of stuff these days, you think?
I can answer some of that question, actually. We are April of this year. We will celebrate the 10th anniversary of Ross's Shadows Angeles game, which was started in... roughly 10 years ago, started with about 6 people. It has gone through about 4 or 5 different iterations, advancing in time from, I think we're, it's gone up through 20 years of history. It will be, actually that's what I'm running tomorrow night for Ross and Sean and some others, is a kind of con game that I made for that. Ross is running a con game at Genghis Khan. Last year I ran Shadows Angeles Adventures at Gen Con and UConn up in Ann Arbor, and people are talking about in my group here in Maryland, we're like, well, when this campaign ends in about 6 weeks, six sessions, and maybe a year out, you know, there's some of us going, well, I'd like to run this. And we take the break, as Aaron would, because people are kind of starting to burn out on it, but the GM wants to finish his arc. We understand that. And so once we finish, We'll go to a different setting. We'll go to a different system, and then when the time is right and people are up to it, and somebody comes out and goes, "I've got an idea for another scenario or a campaign set in the setting," we all jump back into it.
I think what Mike's saying is that a compelling campaign can live on.
Yes.
Over time, you know, even if you change groups, even if you change. Take a break or come back to it. Like, I'm running Birthright, and this Birthright is the same Birthright that I ran, you know, 20 years ago in the Army. I've got a friend of mine running, you know, playing with us now who remembers those games, and we're including things from those games. So, you know, that is a campaign that has lasted, even though we took, you know, many decades-long breaks, things like that. But, you know, anything that's compelling, Sean runs a very compelling game of Shinetar, runs a very, very compelling game of Crawlers and Paragons, and I'm sure that if we ever go back and play those again 10 years from now, it'll still be in the same compelling, awesome game.
Well, I was going to say, the Shinetar that I've been running since, I can't even think anymore, I very much wanted to have the long-term thing. So I let people keep their characters from con games, and then if they showed up at another con, they could continue on as though they had the same continuity. And I still do that, and there's people ready for me to get back to running Shinetar. I've been taking a long break from it. And the Modern God setting that I'm developing for Prowlers and Paragons for this year is an extension of the same superhero campaign I've been running since the 80s. You know, I still call back to characters that were created at that time. So it is essentially the same universe. And there are players who have characters from back then who would be able to recreate those characters and continue to play. And again, inspired by Aaron. There's no question that what I want to do with Modern Gods is absolutely 100% inspired by what Aaron did with Strikeforce.
Mm-hmm.
And I so killed the conversation.
Let me drop. I saw something that got posted on Facebook, and I'm sorry, I don't remember what it was linking to, but it talked about the importance of Session Zero. And this is actually something that Aaron was doing. So going back to the idea of the season, you're like, well, wait a minute. If you come back to Strikeforce after a 4 to 6 month break, what do? Well, you spend the first session talking to each other and Aaron. This is what I want to do with my experience points. Hey, 5th edition just came out. If I can convert over, this is what it does. Yes, you can do that. Where were we last left off? So the first session was always a session zero where everybody it got back on base as to where all the plots were and where they were going and what was going on. And this is also the point where somebody might say, I'm retiring this character because I'm done and we're going to start the new season or the new session or the new arc with a new character. And that's something else I think that is an interesting synchronicity there, that the idea of starting out any campaign or even a new arc of that campaign with a session where you sit down and discuss with each other what it is you want or what's going on or where were you, it's always a good idea to get everybody on the same page.
So with the Kickstarter obviously doing well and then poised to rocket continually ever onward, we have authors for stories. Do we have any plans for seeing this in four color?
You mean comics?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
You're not the first person to ask. We've had several people say, you know, we'd love to see Strike Force comics. But, you know, the fact of the matter is I know fiction really well. I know game stuff really well. One thing I'm not an expert in is comic books. If there's somebody out there who is and wants to approach us and say, hey, let's talk about making a comic line out of it, you know, absolutely talk to us. But I don't think we have anything on the radar for that, just because I don't think any of us is really expert in that particular area.
It's an area that could be interesting to explore, but we'd also have to talk about everyone who has rights involvement and whether they're comfortable with that. It's a conversation worth having, but we can't say that we're going to do it right now. We can just say that it's interesting, and we'd love to look at that later. We're going to see how successful what we're doing right now is first.
And well, you've blown it through $20,000, and how long has it been? A couple days? A week?
A little over a week at this point. We launched last Monday, so yeah, we've got about 3 weeks left to go on it, and we're hoping. I feel really confident we're going to hit that $30,000. It's just the question of how much further we can go, because I'd really like to get that fiction book unlocked. I'd really like to start talking about some of the other projects we got down the road. Like, I mean, Steve, you know all about the Circle of Medi and the Blood, right? You'd love to see a new version of those, wouldn't you?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I have all of those original source books, you know, that Aaron wrote. I think it would be great to see, you know, updated versions of those aspects of the Strike Force world.
And well, those, I know of.
Those are just the tip of the iceberg, what he wrote in the 80s.
Yeah, I mean, knowing what I know about the Blood now, I'd love to do a full Blood source book, and you know, we could do source books on some like Earth Kaiser. You know, I'm talking to Ross. I'm like, Earth Kaiser is 114,000 words. We're gonna have to cut that
down. That's a book right there.
Yeah, it's a bad.
That's a couple of books right there. Yeah.
And by the way, in case you're gonna go, wait, what is he talking about? Earth Kaiser is the world where it is the same time frame as Strike Force's universe. So it was 1996 when they visited. Except that World War II had never ended.
Never ended.
Now, the best part about it is Aaron's a novelist, so he goes into really a great detail about his alternate universes and what they're like. He doesn't just say, okay, here's, you know, what happened when the World War II never ended. He also tells you, here's the slang that they use. Here's what people dress like in America at this time. Here's the kind of music that they're listening to. He gets you very immersed into that world, and it would be very easy for a game master to pick that up and say, okay, I'm going to put you guys in this other universe, and it's going to feel like a completely different world. It's not going to, I'm not just going to have to describe it to you. You will know that you're there.
And actually, this is the, I think the great thing about this Strike Force book is that it goes into a little bit more detail about the multiverse, about the aliens, about technology, and so that you could, it, like, suppose in the future we could put the book out. You could say, look, I this doesn't have to be part of Strike Force's universe at all. I could just take Earth Kaiser all by itself and run with this as a setting where you are in this setting, completely devoid of any connection to the rest of Strike Force. Or you could take the Strike Force book and just cherry pick the parts you want, drop them to your own universe, make a new universe of it. Even if you're not like, I'm not a Champions fan, you come to me and say that, I'm gonna be like, but do you like superheroes? Do you like, you know, near future anything? The book is loaded with stuff that you can use in pretty much any campaign of that type. It doesn't have to be Champions, that even though it says it on the cover, don't worry about that. Look at the content. Look at what we're talking about, what he's describing, and some of the aspects. You can apply that to any costume heroic universe.
Yeah.
So what's the response been like from the Heroes fans? The guy, I think that they've got to be head over heels for something like this.
Most of them.
Thus far, a lot of them have been extremely excited about it. Yeah.
Yeah. I can say that a lot of them are all about buying in at the level that gets you the archive. And there's some guys who, one guy even admitted that he, the book will be nice, but he really wants to dig through the archive.
Hell yeah.
And I wish I had time. Good God.
Well, let's say this. Let me point something out, because we're all beating ourselves up going, how come we can't do this? Well, very few of us are lucky enough to have a full-time freelance writer as a GM, which means that he can devote a lot of time to doing this, as opposed to going out, you know, getting up and going to work and coming back and thinking about it on the train or something. Being a writer, having the ability to, I think, format and pigeonhole all this stuff like he did. I think he was always thinking about this kind of material. And not many of us, unless you're like, you know, when Ross was around, are lucky enough to have somebody who's being asked to write gaming material and then comes to his players and goes, I'm being asked to write this book, so we're going to play a campaign in the book so I can figure out what I'm going to put into it.
Well, I mean, I am a full-time – I mean, this is my full-time gig, and I still have a hard time trying to do all the things that he managed to do. And the one thing I was giving myself some credit for, which is, well, I've got lots of different games going on, but now I'm hearing – and I didn't even realize this until you talked to Dan. Like, he had multiple games going on, and he managed it for all of his games. I hate myself. You know, it's like, I suck, comparatively speaking. It's just – that's so frustrating. It's wonderful, don't get me wrong, and I'm, you know, looking forward to trying to figure out how to do that, but it's just like, wow, I'm an imposter. That man was amazing.
Well, that's one of the things that – we're really happy about with Strike Force is it's our chance to tell people about Aaron and to be a tribute to this guy who was a creative genius and an absolutely driving force in the industry in the early days, and just a brilliant novelist. I mean, he was able to do so many things and do them all very, very well. But amongst all of his accomplishments and his achievements, I think the biggest one is that he was a great friend and an amazing mentor, and he would just take anybody under his wing at any time and tell them, yeah, let me tell you how you need, what you need to do, or let me help you, or let me explain to you, you know, the answer to this question that you have. He never turned anybody away. His funeral was held actually at Richard Garriott's estate in Austin, Texas, and it was this beautiful thing. So this book, Strike Force, is our way to say thank you, Aaron, and to, you know, be our monument, if you will, to his lasting influence on this hobby that we all love.
Yeah, I only met him once. I only met him in the airport. I was flying back from Gen Con one year, and we bumped into him for 5 minutes. But I felt that I knew him through all the books that he did, and it was really, for me as a Hero fan from way back, it was a standing rule. If his name was on a Hero product, you were picking it up, because it was worth looking at and holding on to and reading and using.
He was one of our first rock stars, no questions asked, for the whole hobby. I mean, not just for Champions, although he was absolutely our Champions and Hero System rock star, no question, but Steve Jackson Games and D&D and all these other things. And that was before he became famous for, you know, bringing Rogue Squadron and Wraith Squadron to life in the Star Wars novels. And but as Ross said, and he was also a good friend. I was honored to be friends with him, and he helped me at a particularly crucial point in my career. To figure out how to make a go of it and to stay with it, and how to not get bogged down in despair. So, I mean, he means so much to so many of us. I think it's one of the things that we're truly trying to do, and we're really grateful to you guys, for example, as being part of the process of helping us get the word out, is because there are so many people who are part of our hobby now, because our hobby's grown by leaps and bounds. It's bigger than it's ever been. It's fantastic. But there's generations now who did not know his work, did not know his contributions and how important those contributions were. And so we're really hoping this book is a piece of that process of keeping his legacy alive and keeping his and making sure these new generations of gamers are aware of the amazing things that he did and that they can learn something from what he showed all of us.
Yeah. I mean, it bears repeating that Aaron's advice and anecdotes in Strike Force pretty much constitutes a master class in how to be a game master.
Exactly.
And I mean, game master in general, not you know, for any tabletop RPG, not for superheroes specifically, although there's some genre-specific advice, even Aaron's advice on how to enforce and maintain a genre actually applies remarkably well to any genre you want, as far as that goes. So, you know, it really can't be overestimated, the value of a lot of this advice and a lot of this window into Aaron's process, you know, is to a would-be or even, you know, experienced game master.
Absolutely agree.
A lot of talk of, you know, because we do have such a wealth of experienced GMs on this panel, how does a new guy approach Strikeforce and use some of these tips? Or how do you deal with, you know, because Aaron obviously had these amazing, lofty accolades that are just, you know, pounded on top of pounded, and everybody agrees he's so great. What do you do, and is there any advice in the book for a guy who runs a game and it falls flat?
Aaron covered it all. Like we said before, he was very fond of using his own failures and his own trip-ups and his own fumbles as educational points. So, you know, that's actually an easy question to answer, because much of what Aaron teaches is, you know, I struggled through this by figuring it out as I went, and here's what I learned. So it's definitely, you know, as Steve said, the book is by itself a masterclass. Just dive in, start reading, and you'll be inspired.
Yeah, he's got this section called The Top 10 Ways to Ruin Your Campaign. And it's anybody – I've wanted to show this to many GMs over the years, honestly. It seems like common sense advice, but he gets into it it's actually quite deeper than it is on the surface. Like, the number one thing, how to ruin your campaign, is never let the player characters be best at anything. Okay? And that's something that a guy just starting out can read and go, oh, I shouldn't do that. Right.
Yeah.
I think that's easy, and we're going to expand. Like, this is one of the sections I really want to expand on in the GM section, is talking about this top 10 list of how to ruin things, because they're just beautiful. The number 10 is ignore complaints. Just they can complain all day, just ignore them. That's the fastest way to ruin your campaign. And again, I see a new guy just starting out going, oh yeah, I should probably not do that.
So one of the things that I've become known for in the industry, and I've done a few times, is I'm oftentimes asked to, you know, step in and, hey, would you write a GM-related section for this book, or would you be one to contribute to this GM advice section? And I'm always honored, because it's really awesome that people think I have a lot to add there. You know, there's been recent discussions of what they like to call imposter syndrome, and whereas I don't necessarily feel like an imposter, I will absolutely say unreservedly, I'm just standing on the shoulder of the giant there, because everything I know about good GM advice foundationally starts from there. When I wrote the Fantasy Role-Playing Gamers Bible, I specifically asked Aaron, I said, would you mind if I borrowed some of your ideas and things you talked about from Strikeforce to share with the audience for this book? And he was, of course, extremely gracious to let me do so. So, you know, and that book is what kind of established me as somebody who you might want to have do that. I'm like, it's all because of cool stuff that I learned and it built on from that book. So, you know, and I'm going to be honored to write some stuff for that GM section that Ross is talking about. But we're all just expanding on ideas that he built. So it's a great opportunity to construct that next iteration of the textbook. Except, you know, you say textbook, but in this case, this is going to be one hell of a fun read. This is the kind of textbook you would wish you could get if you were actually, you know, having to have it as a class project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, that's true, because Aaron always conveyed his advice in the form of you know, anecdotes and stories from his own experience, and always managed to do it with tongue planted firmly in cheek, with things like his, you know, top 10 list on how to ruin your campaign, and with a great sense of humor. And so, you know, his work is anything but dry, you know, when it comes to that sort of thing, because it really provides a lot of fun insight in addition to useful advice.
And there's no textbook out there that has Man Mountain Thunder in it.
Right?
Oh. I fell in love with that character. Like, who is it? I got to know who this guy is. This is such a great name.
Why don't you guys explain that for the uninitiated?
So
Man Mountain Thunder is a superhero. He's a member of Strikeforce. Mike can tell us all about him.
Man Mountain Thunder came about at two-thirds of the way into the campaign when a character, one of the players, decided to switch characters, and he came in with a Polynesian Japanese sumo wrestler who, overcome by his own hubris, killed an opponent in the ring, not intentionally. So it was not something that he was prosecuted for, but he felt that he realized where he had gone wrong and went off to try to do good, despaired, threw himself into a volcano, and because Aaron's universe had such illuminaries as Doctor Strange and Doctor Fate and a high magic content, the spirit of the volcano picked him up, said, you're going to redeem yourself properly in my eyes, and put him back out in the world as a Japanese word that I do not remember that roughly translates out to Man Mountain Thunder. And he was a sumo wrestler with kudzu for hair who went around using his martial arts to put down the big bad guys, and then would often lecture them at length about where they had gone wrong in their life choices.
I never did understand the kudzu for hair.
I don't know either, but that was how he's described.
I think it's part of the Polynesian culture, Link. I think it has to do with, like, because the spirits and the nature. Honestly, I don't know either. I'm just kind of guessing here, but I think that's what it is.
Well, we better stay south because they got laws against importing kudzu. That's all I'm saying.
Yeah. and he also is a member of the Sentinel Club. He's one of the few guys to single-handedly take down an enemy Sentinel.
Like the big giant robots to fight.
Big giant robots. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I had to cross out and figure out what I was going to I had to reference the, what is Aaron renaming these for publication list? Because like, at one point I'm like, hey, Ross, I don't think I can say any of this part. And he's like, well, nope, we can't say anything about that.
There's this book called Mutant File you could borrow from. I'm just
In fact,
the Minuteman robots.
To the reader, if you're reading the timeline, anytime I have written Minuteman, just scratch that out and write in Sentinel.
So there you go, Sean. It is. Yep. We did.
Hey, I'm important. I feel special. That was my second Champions book, for those who don't know. My first one was High Tech Enemies, and Mutant Fall was my second book. I mean, as far as ones I wrote on my own. So, anyway.
So, gentlemen, with us approaching the witching hour, do we have any final thoughts that we want to get out to people who are interested in possibly Aaron's work and the Kickstarter?
Go click. Go buy.
Yeah, and I think it's worth pointing out that the Kickstarter is quite generous in terms of its previews. Check that out because you're going to get a really good sense of some of the amazing stuff that's awaiting you as far as that goes.
Yeah, backers get instant access to the work in progress draft of the manuscript, which is at about 78 pages laid out with no art right now. And we're going to be adding on to that shortly. We're going to have all kinds of stuff is happening with the Kickstarter, so please check it out. And we want to say we're really grateful to you guys on the podcast for hosting us, and we're really grateful to all the backers who've helped us get this far. Thank you guys so much. And just, you know, please consider checking out our Kickstarter. If you at all ever want to run a superhero game, or if you think that any of the advice could be useful in your home game, or if you just know Aaron Alston and you want to honor his legacy, you know, please stop by and take a look at the Strike Force project.
You know, I want to throw in that even if you're not necessarily thinking of being a game master, there's so much in this book that would be fun for anybody who's a fan of superheroes, you know, role-playing, superhero role-playing. There's certainly going to be stuff in there to inspire you as a player as well as a GM, and just stuff to delve into to help you think about your own character and your own participation in the campaign. And there's just so many awesome stories to read about a really cool superhero universe that was defined by the role play as opposed to the writer. In other words, you can see how a story evolved and how your own stories could evolve in a similar fashion. So players as well as GMs should want to look at and take a look at this, I think.
I was going to second what Sean said. I was just thinking that it doesn't matter if you're a GM or a player. I would recommend getting it, looking at it, and reading it over and seeing what it's about, what it has advice, because the GM advice may help you play better and get more out of your characters by approaching your GM, may help you be a better GM, or may just be seeds for ideas for characters or campaigns or just entertainment for those who enjoy a good game, a good campaign, and superheroes.
Excellent. Well, as we're, like I said, we're approaching the bottom of the hour, and we've been talking to Michael, Ross, Sean, and Steve on Strike Force. Mike Lafferty would like to apologize. He had to go try on a Mawashi so he could be the next Man Mountain Thunder.
it should be a hereditary title. It should be a title that's passed on, like Dr. Fate.
Absolutely. So, and if you don't know what a Mawashi is, go look up some sumo stuff and then be prepared to be horrified.
Right. Turn safe search on.
My name is Walt, and you've been listening to the Banff Podcast.